Okay, welcome. My name is Divine. This is episode 287 of the Divine Intervention Podcast. In this podcast, I'll be talking about urinalysis and the USMLEs. For whatever reason, urinalysis is a big thing that many people seem to struggle with a lot on USMLE exams. So I'm going to talk through the classic urinalysis scenarios so that when you get questions on these things, you feel very comfortable and you get them right. I wouldn't want a person's ambivalence towards urinalysis to be the reason why they get the question wrong. And then, for those of you that, again, are going to be taking the Step 2CK exam anytime soon, feel free to shoot me an email through the website to sign up for the MBME Test Taking Strategies course and the Comprehensive Step 2CK course. It's a 16.5-hour course. But again, the goal is to cover the vast majority of the high yields you see on the exam. Biostats, ethics, the new stuff that's been tested on the since November of last year, and then expanded content in internal medicine, in peds, in psych, surgery, OB-GYN, neuro. I held the, it's always been a 10-hour course, but again, with all these changes that the USMLE put into place, I expanded the course to 16.5 hours, and the first iteration of the course was a big success, big success. Definitely heard a lot of very good feedback from the course. So if you're interested in signing up, just shoot me an email through the website. The course takes place via Zoom. Okay, so let's just jump right into it, right? So what if they give you a question about a person that has SIDH? What do you expect that person's urine to look like? Well, if you think about it, if a person has SIDH, right, the syndrome of inappropriate EDH secretion, right, obviously it can pop up in a couple of ways on exams. It can pop up in the setting of small cell lung cancer as a paraneoplastic phenomenon. It can pop up in people that are taking SSRIs. Remember, SSRIs, if I'm not mistaken, are the most common pharmacologic agents that are implicated in an etiology of SIDH. It can be a person that has pneumonia on an MBME exam that has SIDH. It can be a person that has a brain process meningitis or whatever, right? Like cryptococcal meningitis that has SIDH. In general, like any brain process, any pulmonary process can actually cause SIDH, right? So these are just all things to watch out for, right? So obviously, antidiuretic hormone is going to reabsorb a ton of water from your urine. So your urine will be very concentrated, right? So your urine osmolality will be really high, right? It'll be really high, at least relative to your serum osmolality will be higher. Now, one nifty way your friends at the MBME go after urine concentration these days is to focus on the specific gravity, right? So focus on the specific gravity. Now, the thing is, the magic number I think I'll encourage you to remember is 1.012, okay? For purposes of USMLE exams, remember the number 1.012. If your urine specific gravity, it basically is a measure. Remember, specific gravity, if you remember from college physics, is a measure of relative density, right? So if your urine specific gravity is less than 1.012, it means the person's urine is dilute. But if the urine specific gravity is more than 1.012, it means that the person's urine is concentrated, right? So what are some things that can cause concentrated urine? Again, if your volume, if a person has SIDH, right? If a person has SIDH, that's going to cause an increase in urine specific gravity because, again, their urine, they are sucking out a ton of water from their urine. So their urine is very, very concentrated, right? So the urine specific gravity will be way higher than 1.012. Usually it will be more than 1.02 on the exam, right? If a person is volume depleted, let's say, for example, they have like pre-renal acute kidney injury, right? Then those people, right, obviously, again, their body will be like, okay, let's try to conserve some fluid. So their urine will be very concentrated, super, super concentrated, right? So the specific gravity in that case will be more than 1.012, right? And if for whatever reason, the person's urine is super hypertonic, right? Again, that's also going to cause an increase in urine specific gravity. So let's say, for example, the person is going through like some kind of diabetic crisis, right? Like DKA or HHNS, because they can make these arrow questions on the exam. In those cases, right, like the person's urine specific gravity will be high because there's just a ton of stuff in it, right? It can be glucose in the case of a person that has diabetes. In fact, one actually unusual scenario is a person that is getting contrast, right? If a person is getting contrast for an imaging procedure, that contrast is a very big hypertonic load. not isotonic, sorry, hypertonic load on the kidneys, right? That's going to cause an increase in the person's urine specific gravity. Again, this is one of those reasons why contrast dye can really tank a person's, can really scrub a person's kidneys, right? That's why they tell you, give these people IV fluids, let them have big time hydration whenever they are taking contrast. And remember, these people should not be on metformin at the time, because again, contrast could potentially torch your kidneys. So if you're taking metformin on top of that, right, that can potentially cause a fatal lactic acidosis in those circumstances, right? And then we know that in terms of a low specific gravity, again, that means your urine is not very concentrated, right? That means the specific gravity of your urine is less than 1.012, right? So what are the things that can cause that? Well, again, if a person is super hydrated, right? Let's say they have like psychogenic polydipsia, for example, right? You drink a ton of water, that's going to dilute your serum osmolality. So your body is going to be like, okay, we can't get hyponatremia here. So let's get rid of some extra fluid, right? So as you're getting rid of that excess fluid, that's going to dilute your urine. So your urine specific gravity is going to be low. It's going to be less than 1.012, right? Or if a person has diabetes insipidus of any sort, right? Basically, that's like the opposite of SIDH. You basically have, you can either have no ADH at all. That's a central diabetes insipidus. Or you can have ADH and it's not effective. That's a nephrogenic diabetes insipidus, right? Like a person can get from lithium, or a person can get from a demeclocycline, for example, right? So in those circumstances, what happens? ADH is not working, so you're not going to be able to anti-diurese your urine. So you're going to keep a ton of water in your urine. So your urine is going to be very dilute. So the specific gravity is going to be less than 1.012, right? And if a person also has, there's this classic thing they love to test, right? If a person has like sickle cell disease, right? Remember, sickle cell disease can cause a nephropathy, right? Those people have a lot of problems with concentrating their urine, right? So if you can't concentrate your urine specific gravity is going to be high, right? It's going to be greater than 1.01. I mean, it's going to be low. So your urine specific gravity is going to be less than 1.012, right? And also, again, when a person has the other kinds of AKI, right, like a post, like an intrarenal, I feel like on NBMs for the most part, they focus for the most part on the pre and the intrarenal. In the intrarenal AKI, your tubular epithelial cells are dead, right? So because the person's tubular epithelial cells are dead, they're not going to be able to concentrate urine, right? So again, the person's urine specific gravity is going to be really low, right? Again, it's going to be less than 1.012, right? So again, be able to tease apart these AKIs, right? Remember, cyclosporine causes a perirenal AKI. That's the mechanism behind its nephrotoxicity, right? It causes a constriction of the afferent arterial, right? So again, if a person is taking cyclosporine, for example, they can give you a urine specific gravity question. The urine specific gravity should be elevated, right? Because again, if you constrict the afferent arterial, you're going to be hypoperfusing the kidneys, right? Again, the body is going to be like, oh, okay, let's start conserving fluid, right? So in those circumstances, your urine specific gravity will be elevated. Or they can give this to you in the context of a person that has an NSAID nephropathy, especially when they have like perirenal AKI from an NSAID, right? Again, NSAIDs, they inhibit cyclooxygenase. So you're going to be making less prostaglandins. So that's going to cause a net constriction of the afferent arterial, right? Again, whenever you're hypoperfusing the afferent arterial, that is usually going to be associated with an increase in urine specific gravity, because the body is like, okay, let's conserve fluid, right? So it will suck up a ton of water from the urine. Okay. And again, the mechanism there, right? Obviously, if you're not perfusing the afferent arterial, then your GG cells will start to freak out. If they start freaking out, they will secrete a ton of renin, right? And then that renin, right, will convert angiotensinogen from the liver into angiotensin 1. And then when that angiotensin 1 gets to the pulmonary arteries, as it traverses the pulmonary capillaries, it will get converted to angiotensin 2. One of the things angiotensin 2 does is that it goes to the supraoptic nucleus of the hypothalamus and causes you to release ADH, right? So when you release that ADH, it's going to cause you to suck up water from your urine, and your urine is going to be very concentrated, right? Remember, another job of angiotensin 2 is that it goes to the zona glomerulosa of the adrenal cortex and causes you to release mineralocorticoids, in this case aldosterone, right? And aldosterone helps you reabsorb more sodium and water from your urine, right? And again, remember that again, angiotensin 2 is also a very powerful vasoconstrictor. Just thought I should throw that in by the side, right? So in a person that is hypoperfused, again, they can give you all these physio, like people think that for some reason, when you get to step 2 CK, when you get to step 3, physiological scenarios disappear on these exams. That's not true, right? They can give you like a systemic vascular resistance question with angiotensin 2. if a person, again, for whatever reason, right, they give you that, oh, this person has a CHF exacerbation. Well, what do you think will be true of their SVR? Their systemic vascular resistance will be increased, right? Because again, if a person has CHF, right, their heart is not working, or cardiogenic shock, their heart is not working, they're not able to pump blood forward, right? So their effective arterial blood volume is decreased. So those people are hypoperfusing the afferent arterial, right? So the GG cells freak out, go through this renin angiotensin aldosterone system cascade. So angiotensin 2 is produced in great measure. That's going to cause a constriction of the vessels in the body, right? So because you have a net constriction of vessels in the body, that ultimately is going to cause an increase in systemic vascular resistance, right? Going to cause an increase in systemic vascular resistance. Okay, so now that we've hit specific gravity, let's see. I mean, I guess maybe this podcast may be a two-part podcast because I have quite a bit of stuff I actually want to talk about, right? So let's talk about urine pH. Let's talk about urine pH. So what are some classic ways your friends at the MBA may go after urine pH? Well, I will say probably like one of the most obvious ones is in the setting of an RTA. Right, is in the setting of an RTA. So remember, there are many kinds of RTAs. There's a type 2 RTA, which is the proximal RTA. There's a type 4 RTA, which is the RTA that's associated with low aldosterone states. And then there's a type 1 RTA, which is the distal RTA, right? That's the alpha intercalated cell RTA. Remember, the type 2 RTA, you can think about it as a proximal convoluted tubular RTA. The type 1 RTA, you can think of it as an alpha intercalated cell RTA. And then the type 4 RTA, you can think of it as a low aldosterone state RTA, right? So let's hit up the one where this is the most, I guess maybe let me, since I'm talking about this, I might as well give you a good algorithm for RTAs. Again, how do you answer RTA questions on your exam? First thing you do is look at the potassium. Is the potassium high? If the potassium is high, the person has a type 4 RTA, the end, right? Because remember, again, a type 4 RTA, I said, is a low aldosterone state RTA. So if you have low levels of aldosterone, well, what is the job of aldosterone normally? Well, if you look at the level of the principal cell of the collecting duct, aldosterone's job is to make you reabsorb sodium and to pee out potassium. So if you have low aldosterone for any reason, right, you're not going to be able to reabsorb sodium and you're not going to be able to pee potassium. So if you cannot pee potassium, you're going to hold on to that potassium. So your potassium will be high. That's the hyperkalemic RTA, right? So what can cause a type 4 RTA? If a person is taking an aldosterone receptor antagonist, right, like spironolactone or eplerenone, that can cause a type 4 RTA because you're essentially having a pharmacologic induction of a type 4 RTA, right? Or if, for example, a person has Addison's disease, the adrenal glands have been shot, especially the cortex, right? Remember, Addison's disease is a destruction of the adrenal cortex, not the adrenal medulla. That's a classic mistake people make. Remember, the adrenal cortex is derived from mesoderm, if I'm not mistaken. The adrenal medulla is derived from neurocrine cells. They have two totally different embryologic origins, right? So like autoantibodies against the cortex are not necessarily going to torch a person's medulla. Just something to keep in mind, right? So if a person's adrenal cortex is gone, well, sadly, they're not going to be able to produce aldosterone. So they're going to get a type 4 RT as a result of that. Another classic one is in Waterhouse-Friderichsen syndrome, right? Remember, a person has meningococcal meningitis. And as they have that meningococcal meningitis, right, that thing, unfortunately, in some cases can spread to the adrenal glands. Well, if it hits up the adrenal glands, especially the cortex, you're going to have an hemorrhagic infarction of the adrenal glands, right? That can cause a primary adrenal insufficiency. That can cause a type 4 RTA. Another classic one is a person that has congenital adrenal hyperplasia, especially the most common cause, 21-hydroxylase deficiency. If you have 21-hydroxylase deficiency, right, think about it, you're not going to be able to make cortisol, right? You're also not going to be able to make aldosterone, right? So if you're not able to make aldosterone, that's going to cause a type 4 RTA, right? That's going to cause a type 4 RTA. That's, again, that's very high yield. That's very high yield to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? So people that have congenital adrenal hyperplasia, they have a normal anion gap metabolic acidosis because they have a type 4 RTA, right? Because they have a type 4 RTA. One very nice unusual question your friends at the MME can throw in there is, which of the congenital adrenal hyperplasias is associated with low levels of aldosterone, but the person does not have type 4 RTA? Well, I would hope in those circumstances you're thinking of 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency, right? So remember, in 11 beta hydroxylase deficiency, You're not able to make cortisol, you're not able to make aldosterone. But because of the enzyme defect, you have a buildup of this compound called 11-deoxycorticosterone, which pretty much works like aldosterone, right? So it has a mineralocorticoid-like effect, right? So it's going to be like you have high levels of aldosterone, but your actual aldosterone levels are low, right? You can maybe almost think of it as a pseudo-hyperaldosteronism, if you may, although I don't think that's a term that's used in the literature, right? So we're talking about RTAs, right? So we said that RTAs, if you notice the person's potassium is high, right, it's going to be a type 4 RTA at the end. Now, if you notice that the person's potassium is low, then all you need to look at is the urine pH. If the urine pH is more than 5.5, right? So remember, we're talking about urine pH. If the urine pH is more than 5.5, that's going to be a type 1 RTA. That's going to be a distal RTA. Because remember, normally, your alpha intercalated cells, they are very helpful in acidifying your urine, you know, to try to keep your urine pH below 5.5. So if for whatever bizarre reason, a person has a type 1 RTA and the alpha intercalated cells don't work, remember, if they don't work, that means that proton pump on their apical surface, their urine surface is not working. You're not going to be able to dump protons into the urine. And if you can't put protons in your urine is going to be very basic. It's going to be more than 5.5, right? So if the urine pH is more than 5.5, think about a type 1 RTA. If the urine pH is less than 5.5, think about a type 2 RTA, okay? So those are the ways you tease apart those RTAs, right? So again, back to this urine pH business. We've talked about how in a type 1 RTA, the urine pH will be more than 5.5. But in a type 2 RTA, the urine pH will be less than 5.5. Remember, another thing, I guess, this is not urine pH, but it's a closely related concept, is vaginal pH, right? Especially with those vaginal infections, right? If you're comparing Trichomonas to Candida to Gardnerella vaginalis with bacterial vaginosis. Remember, in bacterial vaginosis and in Trichomonas vaginalis, right, the vaginal pH in those people, right, usually is going to be more than 4.5. But if it's 4.5 or less, you're probably thinking more along the lines of Candida, right? In terms of the vaginal pH, right? And then remember that whenever you have a low urine pH that is very low, a urine pH that is very acidic, it can actually increase your risk for certain kinds of stones, right? It can increase your risk for like uric acid stones. It can increase your risk of cystine stones, right? So C-Y-S-T-I-N, right? Because those acidic environments promote precipitation of those kinds of stones, right? Whenever you have an overabundance of hydrogen ions, that's going to promote the presence of like a uric acid stone and a cystine stone, because those are acid-based stones in a sense, right? So remember, like begets like, right? So if an acidic like stone sees an acidic environment, they'll be like, oh yeah, time to enjoy, right? Time to have Thanksgiving, right? So just something to keep in mind. But if your urine pH is very high, right, and usually they'll make this like crazy high, like 7 or something ridiculous, right, remember that there are certain things you may want to keep in mind there, right? One is it increases a person's risk for like strovite stones. Remember, those things are also called ammonium magnesium phosphate stones, right? And also calcium phosphate stones, those are also promoted in the presence of a basic urine, right? And remember that your friends at the NBME, they love to test this basic urine with nephrolithiasis as well. Remember, if you notice that a person has a kidney stone, but the urine pH is really high, then you want to be thinking about bugs that are urease positive, right? Bugs that have the ability to split urease, right? So for example, like Proteus mirabilis, that's a classic one they love to test with those Staghorn calculi. Remember, one buzzword on NBME exams for Proteus mirabilis is the fact that it has swarming motility, right? It has swarming motility. And then don't forget, Staph saprophyticus. Remember, Staph saprophyticus is the second most common cause of UTIs. Remember, the number one is E. coli, right? About 85% of UTIs are caused by E. coli. But Staph saprophyticus is urease positive, right? It causes about 10 to 15% of UTIs, especially in sexually active young females. And then don't forget as well, Uroplasma uralidicum. Again, that's another urease positive bug. It can absolutely cause a very high urine pH, right? So again, all those things you want to keep at the back of your mind for exams, right? You want to keep at the back of your mind for exams. Now, another classic thing with urinalysis, again, since I've kind of hit on the pH pretty hard, is just looking for blood in a person's urine, right? Looking for blood in a person's urine. Again, if a person's urinalysis is showing like a ton of blood, right? Let's see, 3+ blood or 4+ blood. If you do a urine microscopy, you're supposed to find a commensurate number of red blood cells, right? So like, you know, red blood cells in the tens per hyperophil. So let's say you're seeing like 4+ blood in your urine, right? On your analysis, you should be seeing like 30, 40, 50 red blood cells per hyperophil. But if you notice that you're only seeing 0 to 2 red blood cells per hyperophil on urine microscopy in the presence of 3 or 4+ blood on your analysis, then you know that that person has rhabdomyolysis, right? Person has rhabdomyolysis. Remember, I think of rhabdomyolysis as the albuminocytologic dissociation of the urine. Remember, albuminocytologic dissociation is a classically described concept in a person that has Guillain-Barré syndrome. In Guillain-Barré syndrome, right, because, okay, let's maybe look at normal CSF. Normal CSF, if you notice that there's an increase in protein, there's usually an increase in white blood cells to go along with it, right? But if you notice that, wow, the protein is very high in the CSF, but I see very few white blood cells, like 0 to 2 white blood cells per hyperophil. There is no agreement between the amount of protein and between the number of white blood cells. That's why it's called albumin, protein, cytologic, cyto, cells, dissociation, right? So that's how you tease those two apart, right? So whenever you look at a person's urine and you're noticing that, wow, I see 3+ blood, I see 4+ blood on urinalysis, right? But then I'm seeing only like 0 to 2 red blood cells per hyperophil. That person has rhabdomyolysis, right? From muscle breakdown of some sort, right? But again, if you're seeing pure red blood cells in a person's urine, you know, that tells you the person has hemoglobinuria. The person may have like kidney injury, right? They can have nephrolithiasis. Classically, people that have nephrolithiasis, they have red blood cells in their urine on NBME exams. People that have nephritic syndrome, they have red blood cells, right? But those red blood cells are described more as being dysmorphic, right? So like red blood cell casts, they can call them dysmorphic erythrocytes on NBME exams. Or if you see pure blood, again, that can also be a telltale sign, especially in a person that has lost weight or a big long-term smoker. You're probably thinking of the person having renal cell carcinoma, right? Or bladder cancer, right? Renal cell carcinoma, bladder cancer, those things tend to cause like just straight up red blood cells in a person's urine, right? And also if a person has a Wilms tumor, right? Wilms tumor can also cause hematuria, right? Wilms tumor can cause hematuria. I remember in a child, right, that had an upper respiratory infection recently, red blood cells, again, you know, like 2 to 6 days ago, you're thinking about IgA nephropathy. Or if it's 2 to 6 weeks ago, you're thinking more along the lines of a post-infectious or what is also called post-streptococcal glomerulonephritis, right? So those are all things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams, right? So things you want to keep at the back of your mind on exams. And then glucose, right? If you detect a ton of glucose in a person's urine, that's usually because their plasma glucose is pretty high, especially if it's more than 180 milligrams per deciliter. If your plasma glucose is more than 180 milligrams per deciliter, you're actually going to start seeing glucose in the person's urine, right? But again, it's not the only that a person has diabetes that makes them have glucose in their urine, right? If a person has like Fanconi syndrome, remember Fanconi syndrome is a proximal tubular problem, right? You know, so that will obviously cause a type 2 RT as well. But in addition to that, you can also have glucosuria as a result of that, right? You can also have glucosuria as a result of that. And whenever you have a ton of glucose in your urine, that's going to increase your risk of candidal infections. That's going to increase your risk of neck fascia of the perineum, right? That's the thing that's called Fournier's gangrene, right? I mean, like, they can very easily give you an SGLT2 inhibitor question with this, where the person has like this, and this is going to be in a diabetic. Like, usually people that have neck fascia on NBME exams, almost as a rule, have a past medical history of diabetes, right? So you check the person's you check the person's, because SGLT2 inhibitors, right, what do? So drugs like canagliflozin, dapagliflozin, and empagliflozin, they inhibit the SGLT2 receptor, right? They inhibit that SGLT2 receptor in the proximal tubule, right? So that you don't, remember, SGLT2 means sodium glucose linked transporter 2, right? So you don't reabsorb glucose in the urine at the proximal tubule. So if you don't reabsorb that glucose, right, it's going to show up in your urine, going to increase your risk of UTIs, especially candida, right? And you may also wonder, oh, why do pregnant women get UTIs? Well, pregnant women get UTIs for many reasons, right? The main primary reason on NBMEs is they have high levels of progestin, right? And progestin is a smooth muscle relaxant. So it will cause dilation, it will cause relaxation of the ureters, right? So they will have urinary stasis, and that's going to increase their risk of having UTIs, right? Because whenever you have stasis of anything, bugs can build up in that thing, right? Bacteria can build up in that thing. But another classic reason why people that are pregnant get UTIs is, people that are pregnant, they tend to have a higher incidence of glucosuria, right? Why? The thing is, if you remember from step one, you probably remember learning about like transport maximums of the glucose transporters in the kidneys, in the proximal tubule. The thing is, those transport maximums, they actually go down when a person becomes pregnant, right? So let's say maybe what, maybe again, I'm just making up numbers here, right? Let's say what is 180 milligrams per deciliter as a threshold for you to start seeing glucose in the urine in a normal person. It's now like 140 milligrams per deciliter in a person that is pregnant, right? So people that are pregnant, they tend to have a ton of glucose in their urine, right? That's why they have a high risk of UTIs. That's why it's very important as a pregnant person to basically not have diabetes if you can avoid it, right? So I usually tell people that are pregnant, you know, watch your weight, exercise, all those things. It just makes your pregnancy go a whole lot smoother, right? And it also makes your delivery go a whole lot smoother. Again, remember though, this podcast is, I'm going to put this disclaimer, this podcast is not for medical advice, right? It's not for medical advice. It's primarily for exam purposes, right? So please don't necessarily follow or reject any advice in this podcast. Just FYI, I feel like I need to throw in that legal disclaimer, right? So those are all things you find with glucosuria on MM exams, right? And then, if you find ketones in a person's urine, right? If you find ketones in a person's urine, well, remember the ketones that you can detect in the urine are acetone. You can detect acetone in a person's urine. You can detect acetoacetic acid in a person's urine. You absolutely cannot detect beta-hydroxybutyrate in a person's urine. That's very important to know. That's very high yield to know, right? So what are some things that can cause ketones in a person's urine? The obvious DKA, right? The obvious DKA, right? DKA can cause a ketosis, right? So you can see ketonuria, right? But also don't forget, if a person has starved, right? I mean, if you've starved, then you're going to be using ketone bodies as your source of energy. So those ketone bodies, again, acetone and acetoacetic acid, those will show up in your urine, right? If a person has been vomiting, right? If you're vomiting, right, that means you are not, usually people that have vomited for, you know, for a lengthy period of time, they're not able to get any food into them, right? They're not able to keep anything down. So because they're not able to keep anything down, well, their body will be like, okay, well, you're not eating. Let's go ahead and start making ketone bodies for energy, right? So those people can have a ketonuria. And again, also if you're pregnant, right? Pregnancy is also one of those natural, relatively natural causes of some ketonuria, right? And then leukocyte esterase. Remember, if your leukocyte esterase is positive, that tells you, remember, leukocyte esterase, right? So esterase, that means it's an enzyme that is found in leukocytes, right? Not a big, huge surprise there, right? So the thing is, it just tells you that, oh, there's white blood cells in your urine, right? So that can be from a UTI, right? That's probably like the classic thing on MBM exams, right? And one thing I just want to mention, if you notice that a person's leukocyte esterase is positive, but you're not seeing any bugs, you're not seeing any bacteria, that's a telltale sign on MBM is that the person likely has chlamydial infection. Just something to keep at the back of your mind. And then nitrites, right? Remember nitrites, if it's positive in your urine, it pretty much suggests that the person, you know, very likely has some kind of UTI. Because remember, bacteria, they convert nitrates to nitrites. So if your urine is nitrite positive, that tells you that the person likely has a UTI. And but having a negative nitrite, though, does not rule out a UTI, right? I'll just say that right now. The thing is, this nitrite test in the urine is very specific for UTI, but it's not sensitive, right? So if you have nitrite negative urine and the person has like the right symptoms, you should still treat them for a UTI. That's a very classic MBM scenario that they love to go after, right? Now, let's maybe go over some other quick hits and then maybe we'll go ahead and wrap up here. So what if you find squamous cells in a person's urine, right? What does that tell you? Well, that just tells you that it's a contaminated urine specimen, right? So you should, you know, do a better job on obtaining the person's urine next time, right? And then if you see hyaline casts in a person's urine, well, what does that tell you? Usually on MBM exams, it means the person's urine is concentrated, right? And usually they'll give you corroborating information like an elevated urine specific gravity, which is, you know, more than 1.012. Right? And then don't forget, if you find these granular casts, right? Sometimes they may call them pigmented granular casts. Sometimes they may call them muddy brown casts, right? These are classically associated, right, with acute tubular necrosis on MBM exams. Remember, acute tubular necrosis on MBMs, they don't always have to call it acute tubular necrosis. They can call it intrarenal AKI, right? It's literally the same thing, right? Just something to keep in mind on exams. And then don't forget your red blood cell counts, right? You're going to find out with like nephritic syndrome, right? Or a person having like some kind of glomerulonephritis, right? And then if you see leukocyte casts, right? Again, that's usually indicative of like pyelonephritis on MBM exams. If you find eosinophils in the person's urine, right? Don't forget acute interstitial nephritis, right? Don't forget acute interstitial nephritis. That's something you may see. You may see on an NBME exam, right? And then don't forget, right, again, the shapes of your urine crystals, right? And when a person has like a nephrolithiasis, right? So if a person has a calcium oxalate stone, remember, this can be people that have Crohn's disease, because when people have Crohn's, their terminal ileum is torched. When you torch the terminal ileum, that's going to cause increased reabsorption of oxalate, right? That's going to predispose the person to forming oxalate stones. Or, you know, person drinks a ton of antifreeze, right? Usually like an alcoholic, ethylene glycol poisoning, right? Think about calcium oxalate stones. Remember, those things are envelope shaped, right? Very important. Those things are envelope shaped. Sometimes if they want to mess with your head, they will tell you that it's dumbbell shaped, right? So calcium oxalate crystals on NBM exams are either envelope shaped or dumbbell shaped. Just remember the term ED, like emergency department, or I guess you can think of erectile dysfunction. The E for envelope, the D for dumbbell, right? And you keep that straight. Right. And then remember, if a person has like calcium phosphate stones on NBMEs, right, like those stones, they tend to be like almost like star shaped. Right. This is not something for any many resources, but they look like prisms in a sense. They're like needle shaped or like star shaped. Think about calcium phosphate stones in those circumstances. And remember, calcium phosphate stones, people that have a distal RTA, especially like the type 1 RTA, they tend to have a very high incidence of calcium phosphate stones. Again, that's an association you want to keep at the back of your mind on NBM exams, right? And then remember, if a person has like a uric acid stone, right? Person has a uric acid stone. Again, those tend to be rhomboid shaped, right? Remember, you can get uric acid stones in a person that has like tumor lysis syndrome, right? So for example, let's say you're being treated for chemotherapy, right? For some cancer of some sort. Right. And then, you know, killing a ton of especially these hematologic malignancies, a ton of cells are dying. Well, they're going to release all those purines. Those things are going to be converted by xanthine oxidase into uric acid. Right. That's why those people, you tend to give them like allopurinol or febuxostat, right? Xanthine oxidase inhibitors, so that they don't get a crystalline nephropathy. Another thing you can also do is to just hydrate them a ton. Right. But also you can also give a uricase analog. Right? Remember, drugs like rasburicase or pegloticase. Those are uricase analogs. They convert uric acid to allantoin. And convert uric acid to allantoin, right? That allantoin is soluble in urine. Uric acid is not, right? That's how you're going to persons getting the crystalline nephropathy in the first place, right? So those uric acid stones, they tend to be rhomboid shaped on NBM exams, right? And then remember struvite stones, right? Those look like coffins, right? They have like these coffin lid shapes to them, right? Again, the person's urine is alkaline because they have like some uris positive bug that's causing problems like Proteus mirabilis, Uroplasma urolyticum, right? Staph saprophyticus. You can remember that with a mnemonic PUS, you know, like PUS, like P-U-S. So, you know, Proteus mirabilis is the P, Uroplasma urolyticum is the U, and then Staph saprophyticus is the S, right? And then cysteine stones, right? Cysteine stones. Remember, if people have like a COLA, C-O-L-A transporter defect in the proximal tubule, they'll make a ton of cysteine stones. Remember, those are shaped like benzene rings, right? So those are hexagonal, right? Those are hexagonal. Again, that's just how you ought to know. How you ought to know for purposes of USMLE exams. And then please don't forget, if you have more than 30 milligrams of urine in 24 hours, right? When you do like the spot urine to albumin creatinine, you know, ratio, especially in diabetics, if you have more than 30 milligrams of urine in 24 hours, sometimes they may call it 30 milligrams per 24 hours or 30 milligrams per gram, right? That's the threshold for microalbuminuria in a diabetic, right? And then if you multiply that number by 10 and take it to 300, then you've hit the lower limited threshold for macroalbuminuria, right? So again, I'll say that again. If you have more than 30 milligrams per gram of urine in 24 hours or 30, so they may call it 30 milligrams per gram or 30 milligrams 24 hours on the albumin to creatinine ratio, the spot, you know, you take the urine and do the albumin to creatinine ratio in a diabetic, that's microalbuminuria. So 30 all the way to 300 is microalbuminuria. 301 or higher is macroalbuminuria. So 301 or higher milligrams per gram albumin to creatinine ratio, milligrams per 24 hours albumin to creatinine ratio, tells you that the person likely has a macroalbuminuria, right? And then don't forget that on NBME exams, right, 1, 2, and 3 plus proteinuria is nephritic range proteinuria. in general, on NBM exams, if they want you to think of nephrotic range rotenorrhea, again, this rule doesn't always work, but it's a pretty consistent pattern like that works like maybe like 90% of the time. For you to say a person has nephrotic syndrome on an NBM exam by looking at the proteinuria of the urine, it has to be 4+ or higher, right? 4+ or higher, right? So that's very important and high yield to know. So let me go ahead and pause this. Go ahead and stop here. I think I've pretty much covered all the things I want to hit up with urine osmolality. So if you're, so, you know, I do offer tutoring for many exams. Step 1, step 2 CK. Step 3, preclinical med school exams. Third year shelf exams. And if you're a medicine resident, I tutor for the medicine boards and the medicine in training exam. So if you need tutoring for any of those things, feel free to reach out to me through the website. Just shoot me an email and I'll be happy to point you in the right direction. I mean, I've worked with tons of people that have, you know, never passed the practice test, failed a USMLE exam, have very poor knowledge bases. And again, I've had an extremely good track record with these people. I mean, I've had tons of people that are, you know, going through the match now, and I've done really well on a practice, on their real exam, after, you know, having like non-passing scores on practice exams, right? And many of these people, I've worked with them for just a short period of time. Obviously, if I work with you longer, it's better. But I've had many of my students have 30-point improvements, 40-point improvements, 50-point improvements, 60-point improvements from the tutoring that I gave them. I gave them for these USMLE exams. So again, I have a great track record as a tutor, and I've tutored for many, many years. And, you know, I've thankfully also won a National Tutor of the Year award. That was actually when I was in undergrad. And again, you know, I've tutored for a long time. So if you need tutoring for any of these exams, I'll be more than happy to help. So just shoot me an email through the website. And then I also do a lot of application advising, especially as ERA seasons come upon us. I do a lot of advising and consulting in those areas. And then please subscribe to the website, again, divineinterventionpodcast.com. If you subscribe, whenever I make a new podcast, you'll get a notification. And then also for people that, you know, use Apple Podcast or Google Podcast or Spotify, I do actually have the podcasts on there, right? So again, feel free, do subscribe if you can. Any feedback, any bit of help or support definitely is appreciated. And then the YouTube channel, you know, Divine Intervention USMLE podcast and videos, subscribe. That's where you see whenever I post a video, I put it on there. So again, if you want to get those things, subscribe to these different resources. And then I'm going to talk about a quick life lesson for today. And my life lesson for today is living a high yield life, right? Living a high yield life. So what do I mean by living a high yield life? Well, the thing is, I will encourage you to maybe do this exercise where you take like your last 3 days and ask yourself, what did I do during the day? Like literally, what did I do during the day, right? Many people, they don't realize that they waste their lives doing things that don't contribute anything positives, like anything positive to their future, right? Like, what percent of your day is invested in low-yield activities? What percent of your day is invested in high-yield activities? Again, I'm not saying that. I'm not using this to say, oh, Divine says I should never rest. No, that's ridiculous. In fact, to be honest with you, sometimes I take my own personal days, right? Because, again, rest is good for a person's mental health. And just so you don't fall apart, right? So, but whenever you have a day of work, let it be a day of work, right? So use your days for high yield activities, because you see many people, they go about their days and they spend 3 hours on social media, 2 hours watching TV, 3 hours chatting with people, blah, 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 blah. And then they notice that all of a sudden, man, like the day has gone. What did I accomplish with my day? Right. And if they check their whole days, they probably spent like 2 hours doing anything that was noteworthy. Right. Anything that will actually contribute substance to their lives. So I'll encourage you to kind of be mindful of that. I mean, this plays out with many medical students, right? They're in dedicated periods. And then, let's say this dedicated period is 9 weeks long. And then by week 6, they start panicking. And then you wonder, I thought you studied for 6 weeks. What happened? Well, the thing that happened is, those 6 weeks, they kept changing their study plans, kept changing their study resources. They never settled on one thing. So they keep changing. Again, the thing I encourage people is, it's not every time that life is supposed to be fun and games. There are some times where you're just supposed to do the boring hard work, stick with one thing, and just go all the way, right? Even the Bible says that he that endures to the end is the one that will be saved, right? So the thing is, sometimes you just need to pick one resource and stick with it. Even if it doesn't seem like it's working out, keep using it. At some point, things will start clicking for you, especially if it's like a well-selected resource at the beginning, right? That's why when you're doing these long-term things, make one good plan from the beginning that you know that, oh, okay, most people have used this plan and succeeded with it. And again, it doesn't have to be something earth-shattering. You don't have to use like 10 different things, right? So pick one thing and just stick with it and then use it consistently. Don't keep changing. Or you see a friend that is using this new Anki deck that you've never heard of before that, oh, a person used and got a 270. Again, the fact that a person used a deck and got a 270 doesn't mean you're going to use said deck and get a 270. There are also people, for every one person that uses a deck and gets a 270, there's probably like 10 people that use that same deck and get like a mediocre score, something like in the 210s or 220s or whatever. Again, I'm not necessarily calling those mediocre scores, right? Again, everything in life is all relative, right? Or you see like residents. You see residents and you're like, man, sign out is at 3. You see these residents at 2230. They are still banging out notes. What were you doing with your day? Let me tell you this. It doesn't matter how busy you are. In general, as a resident, I'll say like almost like 95% of the time, you can get your work done in an extremely timely fashion. But you see many people, they spend 2 hours of their day chatting with all the other residents. Things that are not profitable, right? You see them, they go around, they do this, they do that, just dragging their feet, right? No sense of urgency. Remember, there's a part of the Bible that says that we should redeem the time because the days are evil, right? And because you see people, they just take their day like this, oh, that the day is going to wait for them. Let me tell you this, when time is gone, you are not getting it back, right? So live your life as a high yield life. And one great way to live your life as a high yield life is to have a plan for your day. Have a plan for your day. Plan out your rest times. Plan out your goof off times. But also plan out your day. When you plan out your day, you're highly unlikely to waste your day on fluff, right? So again, I know this thing may seem very basic, but it's extremely important. Many people, especially in healthcare, they waste their lives. Because you see people, they have 4 or 5 patients that they are taking care of. And you see them around 2 p.m. in the afternoon. They are still struggling to write notes. They are still struggling to key in others. They are still struggling to call in consults. No, it's not supposed to be. In fact, there are some people that I almost do like an intern school for, where I coach them on how to do well as interns. And one of the things I go through with these people is just how to be efficient. You see people, they're admitting a patient. It's taking them 3 hours to do an admission. Again, I'm not saying that a person cannot be slow starting out. But the thing is, after a while, you need to take responsibility and be better. Be better at your job, right? And many times, if you check those 3 hours, those people don't have any streamlined process they use for any of these things, right? Just to admit a new patient, they spend 3 hours. No, it's not supposed to be so. Like really, if a person is doing a good job, you should be able to, from when you get called on an admission to when you've written your note, seen the patient and everything, that process should take you no more than an hour if you know what you're doing, right? So all these things are just things that if you practice, prepare, plan for, you don't put yourself in these sticky situations. So again, I encourage you as I sign off today, live a high yield life. Live a high yield life. It will be to your benefit, right? Live a high yield life as a resident. Live a high yield life as a med student. Live a high yield life as a parent. What are you focusing on? Like literally, what are you focusing on? You see some people, they spend so much time at work, they abandon their family, right? They are like absentee parents to their kids. Guys, girls, it's not supposed to be so, right? You should have certain priorities in life. Like for me, what are my priorities in life? My priorities in life are my relationship with God. That's one. But other priorities I have, my family. My family comes second for me. It's very important, right? Using my talents and gifts to glorify God, right? Like I know I love to teach, right? So like I spend most of my life on those three things, right? You know, there are other things that I mess around with here and there, but those things ultimately are not for my benefit, right? So like at the end of the day, like you need to make sure that you are spending your life. Like you see some people, they say like, oh, wherever, that's why I don't, this mentality of, oh, I'll see wherever the wind takes me. I do not believe in any of that, right? Or wherever the wind takes me, wherever the day goes, let's see how today goes. No. Don't have that mentality of, oh, let's see how today goes. No, determine how your day goes. Take charge of your day. right? So again, let's be wise. Let's be wise as people. Let's not be foolish. Because the thing is, foolish people are the people that they come to the end of their lives and they're like, wow, what did I achieve with my life? No, you can achieve something with your life if you take control of your life, right? If you take control of your life. So again, it's very important. So thank you for listening to this podcast. Let me get off my soapbox now. But I'll see you in the next podcast. God bless you. Thank you.